No. Many Indians who come into contact with Westerners make that adaptation. As for your students' advice to you, I am not certain I agree that you should be entirely unprepared. Let me point out that this is not a beginner's retreat. Noble silence, meditation beginning at 4 a.m., little sleep, one meal a day. A difficult regimen. You must be strong. Ah, the train slows. We are at Igapuri. Vijay stood, collected his belongings, and lifted Pam's valise down from the overhead rack. The train stopped. Vijay prepared to leave and said, "The experience begins." Vijay's words offered little comfort, and Pam was growing more apprehensive. "Does that mean we will not be able to speak to one another during the retreat?" "No communication. Not written. Not sign language."
"Email?"
Vijay did not smile. Noble silence is the correct path to benefit from vipassana. He seemed different. Pam felt him already drifting away.
"At least," she said, "it will offer me comfort to know you are there. It is less foreboding to imagine being alone together."
"Alone together. A felicitous phrase." Vijay responded without looking at her.
"Perhaps," Pam said, "we may meet again on this train after the retreat."
"Of that we must not think. Goenka will teach us that it is only the present we must inhabit. Yesterday and tomorrow do not exist. Past remembrances, future longings, only produce disquiet. The path to equanimity lies in observing the present and allowing it to float undisturbed down the river of our awareness." Without looking back, Vijay hoisted his bag onto his shoulder, opened the doors of the compartment, and walked away. 16. Only the male intellect, clouded by the sexual impulse, could call the undersized, narrow-shouldered, broad-hipped, and short-legged sex the fair sex. Arthur Schopenhauer on Women. "Your eternal quibbles, your laments over the stupid world and human misery, give me bad nights and unpleasant dreams. I have not had a single unpleasant moment I did not owe to you." A letter to Arthur Schopenhauer from his mother. Schopenhauer's main woman. The most important woman by far in Arthur's life was his mother, Johanna, with whom he had a tormented and ambivalent relationship, which ended in cataclysm. Johanna's letter liberating Arthur from his apprenticeship contained admirable motherly sentiments, her concern, her love, her hopes for him. Yet all these required a proviso, namely, that he remain at a convenient distance from her. Hence her letter of liberation advised him to move from Hamburg to Gotha, rather than to her home in Weimar, 50 kilometers away. The glow of warm feelings between the two following Arthur's emancipation from servitude evaporated quickly, because of the brevity of Arthur's stay at the preparatory school in Gotha. After only 6 months, the 19-year-old Arthur was expelled for writing a clever but cruelly mocking poem about one of the teachers, and beseeched his mother for permission to live with her and continue his studies at Weimar. Johanna was not amused. In fact, the prospect of Arthur living with her sent her into a frenzy. He had visited her briefly a few times during his 6 month stay at Gotha, and each visit had been a source of much displeasure for her. Her letters to him following his expulsion are among the most shocking letters ever written by a mother to a son. "I am acquainted with your disposition. You are irritating and unbearable, and I consider it most difficult to live with you.
All your good qualities are darkened by your super cleverness, and thus rendered useless to the world. You find fault everywhere except in yourself. Thereby you embitter the people around you. No one wishes to be improved or illuminated in such a forcible manner, least of all by such an insignificant individual as you still are. No one can tolerate being criticized by someone who displays so many personal weaknesses, especially your derogatory manner, which, in oracular tones, proclaims that this is so-and-so, without even suspecting the possibility of error. If you were less like you are, you would only be ridiculous, but being as you are, you become most annoying. You might have, like thousands of other students, lived and studied in Gotha, but you did not want this, and so you are expelled. Such a living literary journal as you would like to be is a boring, hateful thing, because one cannot skip pages or fling the whole rubbishy thing behind the stove, as one can with the printed one. In time, Johanna resigned herself to the fact that she could not avoid accepting Arthur at Weimar while he prepared for the university. But she wrote again, in case he missed the point, and expressed her concerns in even more graphic terms. I think it wisest to tell you straight out what I desire and what I feel about matters so we understand one another from the outset. That I am very fond of you, I'm sure you will not doubt. I have proven it to you, and will prove it to you as long as I live. It is necessary for my happiness to know you are happy, but not to be a witness to it. I have always told you that you are very difficult to live with. The more I get to know you, the more strongly I feel this. I will not hide this from you. As long as you are what you are, I would rather make any sacrifice than consent to be near you. What repels me does not lie in your heart. It is in your outer, not your inner being. It is in your ideas, in your judgment, your habits. In a word, there is nothing concerning the outer world in which we agree. Look, dear Arthur, each time you visited me for only a few days, there were violent scenes about nothing. And each time I only breathe freely again when you are gone, because your presence, your complaints about inevitable things, your scowling face, your ill humor, the bizarre opinions you utter, all this depresses and troubles me, without helping you. Johanna's dynamics seemed transparent. By the grace of God, she had escaped the marriage that she had feared would imprison her forever. Giddy with freedom, she exulted in the idea of never again being answerable to anyone. She would live her own life, meet whomever she wished, enjoy romantic liaisons, but never marry again. And she would explore her own considerable talents. The prospect of relinquishing her freedom for Arthur's sake was unbearable. Not only was Arthur a particularly difficult, controlling person in his own right, but he was the son of her former jailer, the living incarnation of too many of Heinrich's unpleasant features. And there was the issue of money. It first surfaced when Arthur, at 19, accused his mother of lavish spending, which imperiled the inheritance he was to receive at the age of 21. Johanna bristled, insisted it was well known that she served only bread-and-butter sandwiches at her salons, and excoriated Arthur for living far beyond his means with expensive dining and horseback riding lessons. Eventually, such quarrels about money were to escalate to unbearable levels. Johanna's feelings about Arthur and about motherhood are reflected in her novels. A typical Johanna Schopenhauer heroine tragically loses her true love, and then resigns herself to an economically sensible, loveless, and sometimes abusive marriage, but, in an act of defiance and self-affirmation, refuses to bear children. Arthur shared his feelings with no one, and his mother later destroyed all his letters. Still, certain trends seem self-evident. The bond between Arthur and his mother was intense, and the pain of its dissolution haunted Arthur his entire life. Johanna was an unusual mother, vivacious, forthright, beautiful, free-thinking, enlightened, well-read. Surely she and Arthur discussed his immersion in modern and ancient literature. Indeed, it may be that the 15-year-old Arthur made his momentous choice in favor of the Grand Tour, rather than university preparation, because of his desire to remain in her presence. It was only after his father's death that the tone of the mother-son relationship changed. Arthur's hopes of replacing his father in his mother's heart must have been crushed by her hasty decision to leave him in Hamburg and move to Weimar. If his hopes were revived when his mother liberated him from his pledge to his dead father, they were again shattered when she sent him to Gotha. Despite the vastly superior educational resources available in Weimar. Perhaps, as his mother suggested, Arthur intentionally arranged to be expelled from Gotha. If his actions were based on his wishes to rejoin his mother, he must have been disheartened by her unwillingness to welcome him in her new home, and by the presence of other men in her life. Arthur's guilt about his father's suicide had its origins both in his joy of liberation and in his fear that he may have hastened his father's death by his disinterest in the world of commerce. It was not long before his guilt transformed into a fierce defense of his father's good name and a vicious criticism of his mother's behavior toward his father. Years later, he wrote, "I know women. They regard marriage only as an institution for supply. As my father grew wretchedly sick, he would have been abandoned except for the loving charity of a faithful servant who performed the necessary basic acts of caring. My mother held parties while he lay down in loneliness. My mother had fun while he was suffering painfully. That's the love of women." When Arthur arrived in Weimar to study with a tutor for university entrance, he was not permitted to live with his mother, but in separate lodgings she had found for him. Awaiting him there was her letter laying out, with ruthless clarity, the rules and boundaries of their relationship. "Mark now on what footing I wish to be together with you. You are at home in your lodgings. In mine, you are a guest who does not interfere in any domestic arrangements. Every day you will come at 1 o'clock and stay until 3. Then I shall not see you again all day long, except on my salon days, which you may attend if you wish. Also eating at my house those 2 evenings. Provided you will abstain from tiresome arguing, which makes me angry. During the midday hours, you can tell me everything I need to know about you. The rest of the time, you must look after yourself. I cannot provide your entertainment at the expense of mine. Enough. Now you know my wishes, and I hope you will not repay me for my motherly care and love by giving me opposition." Arthur accepted these terms during his 2-year stay in Weimar, and remained strictly an observer at his mother's social evenings, not once engaging the lofty Goethe in conversation. His mastery of Greek, Latin, the classics, and philosophy progressed at a prodigious rate, and at the age of 21, he was accepted into the university at Göttingen. At the same time, he received his inheritance of 20,000 Reichsdollars, enough to provide a sufficient but modest income for the remainder of his life. As his father had predicted, he would have great need of this inheritance. Arthur was never to earn a pfennig from his vocation as a scholar. As time passed, Arthur viewed his father as an angel and his mother as a devil. He believed that his father's jealousy and suspicions about his mother's fidelity were well-founded. and he worried that she would fail to revere his father's memory. In his father's name, he demanded that she live a quiet, sequestered life. Arthur vehemently attacked those whom he considered his mother's suitors, judging them lesser, mass-produced creatures, unworthy of replacing his father. Arthur studied at the universities of Göttingen and Berlin, and then obtained a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Jena. He lived briefly in Berlin, but soon fled because of the impending war against Napoleon, and returned to Weimar to live with his mother. Soon the same domestic battles erupted. Not only did he upbraid his mother for misusing the money he had made available for his grandmother's care, but he accused her of an improper liaison with her close friend, Müller Gerstenberg. Arthur became so brutally hostile to Gerstenberg that Johanna was forced to see her friend only when Arthur was absent from the home. During this period, an often quoted conversation occurred when he gave his mother a copy of his doctoral dissertation, a brilliant treatise on the principles of causation titled On the Fourfold Root of the Principle of Sufficient Reason. Glancing at the title page, Johanna remarked, Fourfold root? No doubt this is something for the apothecary. Arthur, it will still be read when scarcely a copy of your writings can be found. Johanna, yes, no doubt the entire printing of your writings will still be in the shops. Arthur was uncompromising on his titles, rejecting any considerations of marketability. On the Fourfold Root of the Principle of Sufficient Reason should have been more properly titled A Theory of Explanation. Nonetheless, 200 years later, it is still in print. Not many other dissertations can claim that distinction. Ferocious arguments continued about money and about Johanna's relationships with men, until Johanna's patience was exhausted. She let it be known she would never break off her friendship with Gerstenberg or anyone else for Arthur's sake. She ordered him to move out, invited Gerstenberg to move into his vacated rooms, and wrote Arthur this fateful letter. The door which you slammed so noisily yesterday after your improper behavior towards your mother is now closed forever between you and me. I am leaving for the country, and shall not return until I know you are gone. You do not know what a mother's heart is like. The more tenderly it loves, the more painfully it feels every blow from a once-loved hand. You yourself have torn away from me your mistrust, your criticism of my life, of my choice of friends, your desultory behavior toward me, your contempt for my sex, your unwillingness to contribute to my contentment, your greed. This and a lot more makes you seem vicious to me. If I were dead, and you had to deal with your father, would you have dared to schoolmaster him, or try to control his life, his friendships? Am I less than he? Did he do more for you than I did? Loved you more than I did? My duty toward you is at an end. Go your way. I have nothing more to do with you. Leave your address here, but do not write to me. I shall henceforth neither read nor answer any letter from you. So this is the end. You have hurt me too much. Live and be as happy as you can be. And the end it was. Johanna lived for another 25 years, but mother and son were never again to meet. In old age, reminiscing about his parents, Schopenhauer wrote, "Most men allow themselves to be seduced by a beautiful face. Nature induces women to display all at once the whole of their brilliance, and to make a sensation. But nature conceals the many evils women entail, such as endless expenses, the cares of children, refractoriness,
obstinacy, growing old and ugly after a few years, deception, cuckolding, whims, crotchets, attacks of hysteria, hell and the devil. I therefore call marriage a debt that is contracted in youth and paid in old age. 17. Great sufferings render lesser ones quite incapable of being felt. And conversely, in the absence of great sufferings, even the smallest vexations and annoyances torment us. At the start of the next meeting, all eyes were on Bonnie. She spoke in a soft, hesitant voice.
It wasn't such a good idea, after all, to get myself on the agenda, because all week long I've been thinking about what to say, rehearsing my lines over and over. Even though I know that a canned presentation is not the way to go here, Julius has been saying all along that the group has to be spontaneous if it's going to work. Right?
Bonnie glanced at Julius. Julius nodded. Bonnie, try to dump the canned presentation. Try this. Close your eyes and imagine picking up your prepared script, holding it in front of you, and ripping it in half and then in half again. Now, put it in the wastebasket. Okay? Bonnie, eyes closed, nodded. And now, in fresh words, tell us about homeliness and beauty. Tell us about you and Rebecca and Pam. Bonnie, still nodding, opened her eyes slowly and began.
You all remember me, I'm sure. I was the little fat girl in your grade school classroom. Very chubby, very clumsy, hair too curly. The one who was pathetic in gym, got the fewest valentines, cried a lot, never had best friends, always walked home alone, never had a prom invitation, was so terrified that she never raised her hand in class, even though she was smart as hell and knew all the right answers. And Rebecca here? Well, she was my isomer.
Your what? Asked Tony. He sat slouched out nearly horizontally in his seat.
Isomer means like a mirror image, responded Bonnie.
Isomer refers to two chemical compounds, pronounced Philip, that have the identical constituents in the same proportions but differ in properties because of the way the atoms are arranged.
Thanks, Philip, said Bonnie. Maybe that was a pretentious word to use. But, Tony, I want to say that I admire the way you've stuck to your resolution to signal every time you don't understand something. That meeting a couple of months ago when you opened up about your shame about your education and your blue-collar work has really given me permission to talk about some of my stuff. Okay, now back to my school days. Rebecca was my absolute opposite. In every way, you name it. I would have died to have a Rebecca as a friend. I would have killed to have been a Rebecca. That's what's going on in me. The last couple of weeks, I've been flooded with memories of my nightmare childhood.
That fat little girl went to school a long time ago, said Julius. What brings her back now?
Well, that's the hard part. I don't want Rebecca to get angry with me.
Best to speak to her directly, Bonnie, Julius interjected.
Okay,
said Bonnie, and turned to face Rebecca.
I want to say something to you, but I don't want you to be angry with me.
I'm all ears, said Rebecca, her attention fully fixed on Bonnie.
When I see you operate with men here in the group, how you interest them, how you entice them, I feel totally helpless. All these old bad feelings creep out. Chubby, insignificant, unpopular, outclassed.
Nietzsche, interjected Philip, once said something to the effect that when we awake discouraged in the middle of the night, enemies that we had defeated long ago come back to haunt us. Bonnie broke out into a big smile and turned toward Philip.
That's a gift, Philip, a very sweet gift. I don't know why, but the idea of enemies I'd once defeated rising again makes me feel better. Just to have something named makes it more...
Wait a minute, Bonnie, interrupted Rebecca.
I want to get back to my enticing men here. Explain, please.
Bonnie's pupils widened. She avoided Rebecca's gaze.
It's not about you. There's nothing you do that's off. It's all me. It's my response to perfectly normal female behavior.
What behavior? What are you talking about? Bonnie took a deep breath and said,
Preening. You preen. That's the way it seems to me. I don't know how many times in the last meeting you had your barrettes out, your hair down, flouncing your hair, running your fingers through it. But it was more times than I can ever remember before. It's got to be related to Philip's entrance into the group.
What are you talking about? Asked Rebecca.
To quote the old sage St. Julius, a question ain't a question if you know the answer, interrupted Tony.
Why don't you let Bonnie speak for herself, Tony? Said Rebecca, her eyes icy.
Tony was unfazed. It's obvious. Philip enters the group, and you change. You change into a male, what's the right word? You're coming on to him. Do I got it right, Bonnie?
Bonnie nodded.
Rebecca reached in her purse for a tissue and dabbed at her eyes, carefully protecting the mascara.
That's really fucking insulting. This is exactly where I don't want it to go, pleaded Bonnie. This is not about you, Rebecca. I keep saying that. You're not doing anything wrong.
That doesn't wash with me. Making an en passant nasty accusation about my behavior, and then saying it's not about me doesn't make it less nasty.
En passant? Asked Tony.
En passant means, interjected Philip, in passing. A common term in chess used when the pawn takes two squares in its opening move and passes an opposing pawn.
Philip, you're a show-off. You know that? Said Tony.
You threw out a question. I answered it, said Philip, entirely unaffected by Tony's confrontation.
Unless your question ain't a question. Ouch! You got me there.
Tony scanned the rest of the group and said, I must be getting dumber. I feel more out of it. Am I imagining it, or are there more big words getting thrown out here?
Maybe having Philip here is getting to others, too. Not just Rebecca.
Julius intervened by using the group therapist's most common and most effective tactic. He switched the focus from content to process, that is, away from the words being spoken, to the nature of the relationship of the interacting parties.
Lots going on here today. Maybe we can step back a minute and try to understand what's happening. Let me first put out this question to all of you. What do you see going on in the relationship between Bonnie and Rebecca?
It's a tough call, said Stuart, who was always the first to respond to questions thrown out by Julius. Using his professional medical voice, he said,
I really cannot tell if Bonnie has one agenda or two.
Meaning?
Asked Bonnie.
Meaning? What's your agenda? Do you wish to talk about issues with men and your competition with women? Or do you wish to take a swipe at Rebecca?
I see it from both points of view, said Gil. I can see how this dredges up Bonnie's old bad memories. And then I can also see why Rebecca is upset. I mean, she may not have known she was fixing her hair. And personally, I don't think that's such a big issue.
You're tactful, Gil, said Stuart. As usual, you try to placate all parties, especially the ladies.
but you know if you get so deep into understanding the female point of view, you're never going to speak out in your own voice. That's what Philip said to you last week.
I resent these sexist comments, Stuart, said Rebecca. Frankly, a doctor should know better. This female point of view talk is ridiculous.
Bonnie held up her hands and made a T.
I've got to call time out. I just cannot go on. This is important stuff, but it's surreal. I cannot go on with it. How can we go on with business as usual when Julius has just announced last week he is dying? This is my fault. I should never have started this topic today about me and Rebecca. It's too trivial. Everything's trivial in comparison.
Silence. Everyone looked down. Bonnie broke the silence.
I want to back up. The way I should have started this meeting was to describe a dream, a nightmare, I had after last group. I think it involves you, Julius.
Go, urged Julius.
It was night. I was in a dark train station.
Julius interrupted. Try using the present tense, Bonnie.
I should know that by now. Okay. It's night. I'm in a dark train station. I'm trying to catch a train that's just beginning to move. I walk faster to get on. I see the dining car pass by, filled with well-dressed people eating and sipping wine. I'm not sure where to board. Now the train starts to move faster, and the last cars get shabbier and shabbier, with their windows boarded up. The final car, the caboose, is just a skeleton car, all falling apart. And I see it pull away from me, and I hear the train whistle so loud it wakes me about 4 a.m. My heart was pounding. I was soaked with sweat, and I never did get back to sleep last night.
Do you still see that train? Asked Julius.
Clear as can be, moving away down the track. The dream is still scary, eerie.
You know what I think? Said Tony. I think the train's the group, and that Julius's illness will make it fall apart. Right on, said Stuart. The train's the group. It takes you somewhere and it feeds you along the way. You know, the folks in the dining car.
Yeah, but why couldn't you get on? Did you run? Asked Rebecca. I didn't run. It was like I knew I couldn't board.
Strange. Like you wanted to board, but at the same time you didn't want to, said Rebecca.
I sure didn't try hard to board.
Maybe you were too scared to board, asked Gil. Did I tell you all that I was in love? Said Julius. A hush fell upon the group. Dead silence. Julius looked around mischievously at the puzzled and concerned faces. Yes, in love with this group. Especially when it works like it's working today. Great stuff. The way you're working on that dream. You guys are something. Let me add my guess. I'm wondering, Bonnie, if that train isn't a symbol for me as well. That train reeked of dread and darkness, and, as Stuart said, it offers nourishment. I try to do that. But you're frightened of it, as you must be frightened of me or what's happening to me. And that last car, the skeleton-like caboose, isn't that a symbol, a prevision of my deterioration? Bonnie stammered, got tissues from the box in the middle of the room and wiped her eyes.
I don't know how to answer. This whole thing is surreal. Julius, you floor me. You knock me out the way you talk about dying so matter-of-factly.
We're all dying, Bonnie. I just know my parameters better than the rest of you, said Julius.
That's what I mean, Julius. I always love your flippancy. But now, in this situation, It kind of avoids things. I remember once. It was during that time that Tony was doing weekend jail time and we weren't talking about it. That you said if something big in the group is being ignored, then nothing else of importance gets talked about either.
Two things, said Rebecca.
First, Bonnie, we were talking about something important just now. Several important things. And second, my God, what do you want Julius to do? He is talking about this.
In fact, said Tony, he even got pissed that we heard it from Philip rather than from him personally.
I agree, said Stuart.
So, Bonnie, what do you want from him?
He's handling it. He said he's got his own support network to help him deal with it.
Julius broke it off. It had gone far enough. You know, I appreciate all this support from you guys. But when it's this strong, then I begin to worry. Maybe I'm getting loose. But do you know when Lou Gehrig decided to retire? It happened one game when everyone on the team gushed compliments about how he fielded a routine ground ball. Maybe you're considering me too fragile to speak for myself.
So where do we go with this? Said Stuart.
First, let me say to you, Bonnie, that you're showing a lot of guts by jumping in and naming the thing that's too hot to touch. What's more, you're absolutely right. I have been encouraging some, no, a lot of denial here. I'm going to make a short speech and lay it out for you. I've had some sleepless nights lately and a lot of time to think about everything, including what to do about my patients and this group. I haven't had any practice at this. No one practices endings. They only happen once. No textbooks are written about this situation. So everything is improvisation. I'm faced with deciding about what to do with the time I have left. Look, what are my options? Terminate all my patients and end this group? I'm not ready to do that. I've got at least a year of good health, and my work means too much to me. And I get a lot out of it for myself. Stopping all my work would be to treat myself as a pariah. I've seen too many patients with fatal illness who have told me that the isolation accompanying their illness is the worst part of all. And the isolation is a dual isolation. First, the very sick person isolates himself because he doesn't want to drag others down into his despair. And I can tell you for a fact that's one of my concerns here. And second, others avoid him either because they don't know how to talk to him or because they want nothing to do with death. So withdrawing from you is not a good option for me. And what's more, I don't believe for you either. I've seen a lot of terminally ill people who underwent change, grew wiser, riper, and had a great deal to teach others. I think that's already starting to happen to me. And I'm convinced that I'll have a lot to offer you in the next few months. But if we're going to keep working together, you may have to face a lot of anxiety. You'll not only have to face my approaching death, but you may be confronted with your own. End of speech. Maybe you all have to sleep on this and see what you want to do.
I don't need to sleep on it, said Bonnie. I love this group and you and everyone in it, and I want to work here as long as possible.
After members echoed Bonnie's affirmation, Julia said, I appreciate the vote of confidence.
But Group Therapy 101 underscores the daunting power of group pressure. It's hard to buck group consensus in public. It would take superhuman resolve for any of you to say today, sorry, Julius, but this is too much for me. I'd rather find a healthy therapist, someone hale enough to take care of me. So no commitments today. Let's just stay open and keep evaluating our own work and see how everyone feels in a few weeks. One big danger, which Bonnie expressed today, is that your problems start to feel too inconsequential to discuss. So we have to figure out the best way for me to keep you working on your own issues.
I think you're doing it, said Stuart, by just keeping us informed.
Okay. Thanks. That helps. Now, let's go back to you guys. A long silence. So, maybe I haven't liberated you. Let me try something. Can you, Stuart, or others, lay out our agenda? What's here on the table? What are the open issues today? Stuart was the informal group historian. He was blessed with such a retentive memory that Julius could always call on him for an account of past or present group events. He tried not to overuse Stuart, who was in the group to learn how to engage others, not to be a recorder of events. Wonderful with his child patients, Stuart was socially at a loss whenever he left the perimeter of his pediatrician role. Even in the group, he often carried some of the accoutrements of the trade stuffed in his shirt pocket. Tongue depressors, penlight, lollipops, medication samples. A stable force in the group for the past year, Stuart had made enormous progress in, as he had put it, Project Humanization. Yet interpersonal sensitivity was still so underdeveloped that his recounting of group events was entirely without guile. Leaning back in his chair, he closed his eyes before responding. Well, let's see. We began with Bonnie and her desire to talk about her childhood. Bonnie had been Stuart's frequent critic, and he glanced at her for approval before continuing.
Not quite right, Stuart. Right facts, wrong tone. You're making it sound flippant. Like, I just want to tell a story for the fun of it. There are a lot of painful memories from my childhood that are now coming up and haunting me. Get the difference?
I'm not sure I do get it. I didn't say you were doing it for the fun of it. That's just the kind of thing my wife complains about. But to continue, next there was some stuff with Rebecca, who felt insulted and angry with Bonnie for pointing out how she was preening and attempting to impress Philip. Stuart ignored Rebecca slapping her hand to her forehead and muttering, God damn it, and continued. Then there was Tony's feeling that we were using a more complex vocabulary in order to impress Philip. And then Tony commented that Philip was a show-off, and Philip's sharp response to Tony. And then there was my comment to Gil that he avoided displeasing women so much that he lost his sense of self. Let's see what else. Stuart scanned the room. Well, there's Philip. Not what he said, but what he didn't say. We don't talk too much about Philip, as though it's taboo. Come to think of it, we don't even talk about not talking about him. And of course, Julius, but we worked on that. Except that Bonnie was particularly concerned and protective, as she often is about Julius. In fact, the Julius part of the meeting started with Bonnie's dream.
Impressive, Stuart, said Rebecca. And pretty complete. You left out only one thing.
And that is?
Yourself. The fact that you were being the group camera again, photographing rather than plunging in.
Often the group had confronted Stuart about his impersonal style of participation. Months ago, he described a nightmare in which his daughter had stepped into quicksand, and he could not save her because he wasted so much time getting his camera out of his backpack to take a snapshot of the scene. That was when Rebecca labeled him the group camera. Right you are, Rebecca. I'll pack my camera away now and say I agree entirely with Bonnie. You are a good-looking woman, but that's not news to you, you know that. And you know I think so. And of course you were preening for Philip. Doing and undoing and stroking your hair, it was obvious. How did I feel about it? I felt a little jealous. No, a lot jealous. You never preened for me. No one ever preened for me.
That kind of thing makes me feel like I'm in prison, Rebecca shot back. I hate it when men try to control me like this. Like my every movement is under scrutiny.
Rebecca broke off each word, showing an edge and a brittleness that had been under wraps for a long time. Julius remembered his first impressions of Rebecca. A decade ago, long before she entered the group, he'd seen her individually for a year. She was a delicate creature with an Audrey Hepburn graceful, slim body and precious large-eyed face. And who could forget her opening comment in therapy?
Ever since I've turned 30, I've noticed that when I enter restaurants, no one stops eating to look at me. I'm devastated.
Two sources of instruction had guided Julius in his work with her, both individually and in the group. First, there had been Freud's urging that the therapist should reach out in a human way to a beautiful woman, and not withhold himself or penalize her, simply because she was beautiful. The second had been an essay he had read as a student titled The Beautiful Empty Woman, which made the point that the truly beautiful woman is so often feted and rewarded solely for her appearance that she neglects developing other parts of herself. Her confidence and feelings of success are only skin deep, and once her beauty fades, she realizes she has little to offer. She has developed neither the art of being an interesting person nor that of taking an interest in others.
"I make observations and I'm called a camera," said Stuart. "And when I say what I feel, I'm labeled a controlling man. Talk about feeling cornered."
"I don't get it, Rebecca," said Tony. "What's the big deal here? Why are you freaking out?"
"Stuart's just saying what you've said yourself. How many times have you said you know how to flirt, that it comes naturally to you? I remember you saying that you had an easy time in college and in your law firm because you manipulate men with your sexuality."
"You make me sound like a whore."
Rebecca swiveled suddenly to Philip.
"Doesn't that make you think I'm a whore?"
Philip, not distracted from gazing at his favorite spot somewhere on the ceiling, answered quickly.
"Schopenhauer said that a highly attractive woman, like a highly intelligent man, was absolutely destined to living an isolated life. He pointed out that others are blind with envy and resent the superior person. For that reason, such people never have close friends of their same sex."
"That's not necessarily true," said Bonnie. "I'm thinking of Pam, our missing member, who is beautiful too and yet has a large number of close girlfriends."
"Yeah, Philip," said Tony. "You saying that to be popular, you have to be dumb or ugly?"
"Precisely," said Philip.
"And the wise person will not spend his life or her life pursuing popularity. It is a will-o'-the-wisp. Popularity does not define what is true or what is good. Quite the contrary. It's a leveler, a dumbing down. Far better to search within for one's values and goals."
"And how about your values and goals?" asked Tony.
If Philip noticed the surliness in Tony's question, he gave no evidence of it and replied ingenuously.
"Like Schopenhauer, I want to will as little as possible and to know as much as possible."
Tony nodded, obviously baffled about how to respond. Rebecca broke in.
"Philip, what you or Schopenhauer was saying about friends was right on the mark for me. The truth is that I've had few close girlfriends. But what about two people with similar interests and abilities? Don't you think that friendship is possible in that case?"
Before Philip could answer, Julius enjoined,
"Our time is growing very short today. I want to check in about how you're all feeling about our last 15 minutes. How are we doing here?"
"We're not on target. We're missing," said Gil. "Something oblique is going on."
"I'm absorbed," said Rebecca.
"Nah, too much in our heads," said Tony.
"I agree," said Stuart.
"Well, I'm not in my head," said Bonnie. I'm close to bursting or screaming or...
Bonnie suddenly rose, gathered up her purse and jacket, and charged out of the room. A moment later, Gil jumped up and ran out of the room to fetch her back. In awkward silence, the group sat listening to the retreating footsteps. Shortly, Gil returned, and as he sat, he reported,
"She's okay. Says she's sorry, but she just had to get out to decompress. She'll go into it next week."
"What is going on?"
said Rebecca, snapping open her purse to get sunglasses and car keys.
"I hate it when she does that. That's really pissy."
"Any hunches about what's going on?" asked Julius.
"PMS, I think," said Rebecca.
Tony spotted Philip scrunching his face, signifying confusion, and jumped in.
"PMS? Premenstrual syndrome?"
When Philip nodded, Tony clenched his hands and poked both thumbs upward.
"Hey, hey, I taught you something."
"We've got to stop," said Julius. "But I've got a guess about what's going on with Bonnie. Go back to Stuart's summary. Remember how Bonnie started the meeting? Talking about the chubby little girl at school and her unpopularity and her inability to compete with other girls, especially attractive ones? Well, I wonder if that wasn't recreated in the group today. She opened the meeting, and pretty quickly the group left her for Rebecca. In other words, the very issue she wanted to talk about may have been portrayed here in living color, with all of us playing a part in the pageant. 18. Nothing can alarm or move him anymore. All the thousand threads of willing, binding us to the world and dragging us, full of anxiety, craving, anger, and fear, back and forth in constant pain. All these he has cut asunder. He smiles and looks back calmly on the phantasmagoria of this world, which now stands before him as indifferently as chessmen at the end of a game. Pam in India, 2. It was a few days later at 3 a.m. Pam lay awake, peering into the darkness. Thanks to the intervention of her graduate student, Marjorie, who had arranged VIP privileges, she had a semi-private room in a tiny alcove with a private toilet just off the women's common dormitory. However, the alcove provided no sound buffer, and Pam listened to the breathing of 150 other Vipassana students. The whoosh of moving air transported her back to her attic bedroom in her parents' Baltimore house when she lay awake listening to the March wind rattling the window. Pam could put up with any of the other ashram hardships. The 4 a.m. wake-up time, the frugal vegetarian one-meal-a-day diet, the endless hours of meditation, the silence, the Spartan quarters. But the sleeplessness was wearing her down. The mechanism of falling asleep completely eluded her. How did she used to do it? No, wrong question, she told herself. A question that compounded the problem. Because falling asleep is one of those things that cannot be willed. It must be done unintentionally. Suddenly, an old memory of Freddy the Pig floated into her mind. Freddy, a master detective in a series of children's books she hadn't thought about in 25 years, was asked for help by a centipede who could no longer walk because his 100 legs were out of sync. Eventually, Freddy solved the problem by instructing the centipede to walk without looking at his legs, or even thinking about them. The solution lay in turning off awareness and permitting the body's wisdom to take over. It was the same with sleeping. Pam tried to sleep by applying the technique she had been taught in the workshop to clear her mind and allow all thoughts to drift away. Goenka, a chubby, bronze-skinned, pedantic, exceedingly serious, and exceedingly pompous guru,
had begun by saying he would teach Vipassana. But first he had to teach the student how to quiet his mind. Pem endured the exclusive use of the male pronoun. The waves of feminism had not yet lapped upon the shores of India. For the first 3 days, Goenka gave instruction in the Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And the days were long. Aside from a daily lecture and a brief question and answer period, the only activity from 4 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. was sitting meditation. To achieve full mindfulness of breathing, Goenka exhorted students to study in-breaths and out-breaths.
"Listen. Listen to the sound of your breaths," he said. "Be conscious of their duration and their temperature. Note the difference between the coolness of in-breaths and the warmth of out-breaths. Become like a sentry watching the gate. Fix your attention upon your nostrils, upon the precise anatomical spot where air enters and leaves. Soon," Goenka said, "the breath will grow finer and finer, until it seems to vanish entirely, but as you focus ever more deeply, you will be able to discern its subtle and delicate form. If you follow all my instructions faithfully," he said, pointing to the heavens, "if you are a dedicated student, the practice of Anapanasati will quiet your mind. You will then be liberated from all the hindrances to mindfulness, restlessness, anger, doubt, sensual desire, and drowsiness. You shall awaken into an alert, tranquil, and joyous state." Mind quieting was indeed Pam's grail, the reason for her pilgrimage to Igapuri. For the past several weeks, her mind had been a battlefield from which she fiercely tried to repel noisy, obsessive, intrusive memories and fantasies about her husband, Earl, and her lover, John. Earl had been her gynecologist 7 years ago when she had become pregnant and decided upon an abortion, electing not to inform the father, a casual sexual playmate with whom she wished no deeper involvement. Earl was an uncommonly gentle, caring man. He skillfully performed the abortion, and then provided unusual post-operative follow-up by phoning her twice at home to inquire about her condition. Surely, she thought, all the accounts of the demise of humane, dedicated medical care were hyperbolic rhetoric. Then, a few days later, came a third call which conveyed an invitation to lunch, during which Earl skillfully negotiated the segue from doctor to suitor. It was during their fourth call that she agreed, not without enthusiasm, to accompany him to a New Orleans medical convention. Their courtship proceeded with astonishing quickness. No man ever knew her so well, comforted her so much, and was so exquisitely familiar with her every nook and cranny, nor afforded her more sexual pleasure. Though he had many wonderful qualities, he was competent, handsome, and carried himself well, she conferred upon him, she now realized, heroic, larger-than-life stature. Dazzled at being the chosen one, at being promoted to the head of the line of women packing his office, clamoring for his healing touch, she fell wholly in love and agreed to marriage a few weeks later. At first, married life was idyllic. But midway into the second year, the reality of being married to a man 27 years older set in. He needed more rest. His body showed his 65 years. White hair appeared in defiance of Grecian formula hair dye. Earl's rotator cuff injury ended their tennis Sundays together. And when a torn knee cartilage put an end to his skiing, Earl put his Tahoe house on the market without consulting her. Sheila, her close friend and college roommate, who had advised her not to marry an older man, now urged her to maintain her own identity
and not be in a rush to grow old.
Pam felt fast-forwarded.
Earl's aging fed on her youth.
Each night he came home with